By the time Catherine Miller checked into West Penn Hospital, she was already in critical condition. Typhoid fever sapping her of the strength to walk and covering her skin in rosy spots. She spent 8 days in a hospital bed, her temperature climbing and appetite waning, while doctors and nurses quietly tended to her. No one visited. When she finally died, someone notified her father, who arranged to have her body sent to his house on Southern Avenue in Mount Washington for viewing. Her death was a shame, for certain. But hospitals are full of sad cases and lonesome patients. This one probably wouldn't have been especially memorable. Except that the next morning, the Pittsburgh newspapers announced it in bold headlines. Mrs. Kate Soffel dies alone at the West Penn Hospital. Catherine Miller wasn't just a city seamstress who died of typhoid fever. She was Kate Soffel, former wife of the Allegheny County jail warden. 7 years earlier, she'd helped two of her then-husband's inmates to escape. She spent 2 years in prison for her crime, and the remainder of her short life atoning for it. This is the story of how it all happened. Welcome to Nebby, the podcast about Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes. It's been a while, but we're back with new episodes, and this month's begins and ends in one of my favorite Pittsburgh neighborhoods, Mount Washington, back before it was a nightlife and dining destination. Just two quick notes before we get going. Many of the characters in this story are criminals who took on several aliases over the years. To cut down on confusion, I'll refer to them by the names used when they were arrested or convicted. And since this story is about crime, there are several violent incidents that may not be appropriate for kids, or for those who simply don't like to hear about violence. Okay, here's the story. In the early days of 1901, a group of masked intruders tormented the city, committing at least 27 burglaries and making off with thousands of dollars in diamonds, watches, silks, silverware, and cash. The burglars used the same MO every time. They wore black overcoats and fedoras, entered the house or business quietly, and clapped chloroform-soaked rags over the victims' mouths until they passed out. Reporters dubbed them the Chloroform Gang. It was a lucrative operation, and one that managed to confound police, until the morning of April 12, 1901, when three members of the gang broke into Thomas Caney's Albert Street grocery store on Mount Washington. The gang had canvassed the place the evening prior, and so they expected this one to be a quick job. They'd only have to bypass Caney, his wife Sadie, and the 12-year-old son, Earl. But things went wrong quickly. Around 2 a.m., after popping the latch on the kitchen shutter and scrambling through the open window, the burglars realized their chloroform atomizer wasn't working, and Sadie Caney wasn't where they thought she'd be. Young Earl was worried about an upcoming exam at school, and he couldn't sleep, so Sadie had crawled into bed with him. They were still awake when the chloroform gang walked in. One of the burglars managed to smother Sadie's screams with a handkerchief, and another to frighten Earl with a gun. But Thomas Caney heard the commotion from the next room and rushed in. Before Caney could put up a fight, one of the burglars fired his revolver and all three dashed out of the house. Caney gave chase, but the trio quickly disappeared into the darkness. They spent hours cutting across Mount Washington yards and down steep, muddy terrain until they found themselves in Carnegie, a good 6 miles away. They were relieved, figuring, despite the close call, no one knew who they were, where they'd been, or what they'd done. But they were wrong. Because only the day before, police had received their first big break in the chloroform gang case. A tipster revealed the name of the gang's supposed members: Walter Dorman, John Biddle, Edward Biddle, Jenny Wilcox, and Jesse Wright. Police had already planned to raid two of their houses when they learned of the attempted burglary at Caney's store. Black fedoras and coats, revolvers, chloroform. It was definitely the work of the chloroform gang. So just after 11 a.m. on April 12th, less than 9 hours after the break-in at Caney's store, Inspector Robert Gray and Detectives Patrick Fitzgerald and R.G. Robinson arrived at 1714 Bedford Avenue. Upon entering the house, they found Walter Dorman and Jenny Wilcox, along with a stash of revolvers, dynamite, chloroform, diamonds, and watches. It was enough to take the pair down to the Center Avenue police station and book them. Detectives and officers then headed to 34 Fulton Street. They spotted and arrested John Biddle on the first floor without incident. Then they headed to the second floor of the home, where they found John's brother, Edward Biddle, attempting to escape through an open window. When they called for him to stop, he turned and pointed a revolver at them. Everyone opened fire. Within seconds, a bullet struck and killed Detective Fitzgerald. Inspector Gray leapt at Biddle, threw him to the ground, and wrested the gun from his hands. In the police report, Gray explained, "He begged of me not to kill him, said he was done for, and wanted to kiss his wife. I thought at that time he was about dying, as I supposed he was shot 3 or 4 times." Edward Biddle was wounded, shot in the leg, arm, and head. But he still put up a fight, continuing to wrestle with officers as they cuffed him and drove him and his brother to the station. And that wife he mentioned? That was Jesse Wright. Detective Robinson found her hiding in the basement and took her into custody. Police booked all 5 supposed gang members on charges of theft and murder. You see, moments after the gang fled the Albert Street grocery store, Thomas Caney collapsed. A bullet had struck him in the chest. And police believed that bullet came from John Biddle's gun. John and Edward Biddle, or Jack and Ed as most knew them, were born in Amherstburg, a small town on the border of Michigan and Canada. Their father was a tavern owner and railroader who died after being struck by a train. 6 months later, their mother died too. So Jack, Ed, their 4 brothers, and 1 sister went to live with their Uncle Ben, a drunk who repeatedly beat them and kicked them out of the house. One night, he threatened them with a gun, but in his inebriated state, ended up shooting himself in the face. A family friend told the Pittsburgh Press that the children laughed when they realized that he died. Largely left to their own devices after that, Jack and Ed dropped out of school to find work. Jack made his living on farms, while Ed chose the more illicit path of petty crime. Eventually, they both moved to Pennsylvania, where they met Walter Dorman, an Ohio native who had already served time in Missouri and Ohio for a string of Midwestern burglaries. Dorman was bright and handy. He'd created his own tool for cracking safes and enlisted several Pittsburgh blacksmiths to create it, piece by piece, so that no one could determine the end product. His cleverness continued after the gang's arrest. At the coroner's inquest, held just a week after the deaths of Caney and Fitzgerald, a young woman took the stand and identified Dorman as the man she'd seen lurking about the Caney grocery store on the night before the murders. A police detective smiled smugly and whispered to Dorman, "If that girl gives that testimony before a jury, you will hang for sure." Dorman smiled right back. "Are you sure of that?" he asked. Within the month, Dorman had flipped on the Biddle brothers, agreeing to testify at their trial, where he described the crime in detail. In exchange for his testimony, Dorman escaped the death penalty. He pleaded guilty and received a life sentence. Jenny Wilcox and Jesse Wright were acquitted. Jack and Ed Biddle weren't so lucky. A jury convicted them of murder and sentenced them to die by hanging. By November 1901, the Biddle brothers were confined to cells in the Allegheny County Jail, where Warden Pete Soffel and his guards would look after them until their hanging, which had been delayed until at least January. Because although their request for a new trial had been denied, the governor had granted the brothers a 60-day respite, or stay of execution. They used those 60 days to declare their innocence to anyone willing to listen. Ed even suggested a theory. He said that Walter Dorman and Jenny Wilcox, who he claimed often dressed as a man and accompanied the chloroform gang on their break-ins, they had committed the Caney murder together. He and Jack were innocent. One of the guards, Conrad Dietrich, believed him. "I always liked those two boys, especially Ed," Dietrich told a reporter. "I didn't think they murdered Caney. I did not believe they shot Detective Fitzgerald. I never thought they should hang, and other guards in prison felt the same way." So did Dietrich's daughter, Kate Soffel. She was the wife of the warden, and she sometimes ministered to the inmates, reading them scripture and praying with them. She took a particular interest in the Biddle brothers, and the more time she spent sitting next to their cells, the more the guards began to suspect she harbored more than just sympathy. Soffel typically visited the Biddles late at night when her husband wasn't around, and stayed with them for hours, listening as they detailed their nightmarish childhood and protested their incarceration. On at least one occasion, Dietrich agreed to deliver poetry that Ed had written for his daughter to the Soffel home. Kate Soffel responded by tucking notes into the pages of Ed's Bible. While Jack Biddle looked every bit the gangster, with his hawkish nose, deep-set eyes, and unkempt flop of hair, Ed was more refined. The photo that appeared most often in local newspapers showed him in profile, wearing a dark suit, his hair neatly parted. More than one newspaper reporter remarked on his attractiveness and charm. Between that and the illicit exchange of letters, Dietrich began to worry about his daughter, warning her to end what appeared to be a flirtation, noting the damage that it could do to her family. Instead, Soffel attempted to raise money for the Biddles' defense and send a representative to the governor's office in Harrisburg to lobby for their release. When those measures didn't work, she hid a saw under her skirt and delivered it to Ed's cell. Just after 4 a.m. on January 30th, 1902, Ed Biddle called for a guard. Jack was doubled over with stomach cramps, and he needed medication for the pain. The night clerk, James McGarry, quickly responded, remedy in hand. But as he approached the cell, McGarry saw that the two prisoners were armed. Ed grabbed McGarry by his coat, and with one violent motion, Jack knocked out the bars of the cell, which they had sawed through days before. McGarry immediately called for help. But as Jack swung at him, hitting him repeatedly in the face with his gun, McGarry realized he couldn't wait for another guard. He flung himself over a railing and fell 15 feet to the basement floor. Meanwhile, Ed met a second guard in the hallway outside the cell. The two scuffled until Ed managed to fire a shot. The brothers then forced the last guard on duty into what was called the dungeon, a dark room in the jail basement. They dragged the two injured guards into the room with him, locked the three inside, and fled through the jail's Ross Street door. It was 4:30 in the morning, and it would be nearly 2 hours before anyone realized they were gone. Later that morning, Warden Peter Soffel placed a call to his sister in McDonald, Pennsylvania. Kate had retired to her bedroom before 9 the previous night and told her husband she planned to leave early the next morning to travel to her sister-in-law's home. But now the Biddle brothers were missing, and given the rumors about Kate and Ed, the warden suspected his wife had lied about her trip to the Western Borough. His sister confirmed his fears. Kate wasn't there. Soffel rushed into her room and ransacked it. It wasn't long before he found saws stashed beneath a dresser and notes written by Ed Biddle hidden under a rug. The rumors were true. Kate and Ed did have a relationship. And now Peter Soffel had to make a choice. Protect his wife and withhold crucial clues about the Biddles' escape, or turn over the evidence and risk ruining his own career by association. He chose to come forward. The newspapers described Peter Soffel as displaying crushing grief. If true, it was certainly warranted. He and Kate had been together since they were kids. They had 4 children, all under 14 years old. And the county, upon learning about the saws and letters in Kate's room, removed Peter from his job. They also posted a $1,000 reward for the trio's capture, dead or alive. "She will regret her impulsive act," Peter predicted to reporters. "Ed Biddle will desert her. Perhaps he's done so by this time." When the Biddles exited the jail on that morning in January, Kate Soffel was waiting. She'd say later she didn't plan to flee with them, just to make sure everything went as planned. But Ed convinced her to come along. Together, they fled to a house in the city and stayed for much of the day, contemplating their next move. Jack wanted to stay put. Who would think to look for them so close to the crime? Kate wanted to get as far away as possible. Eventually, they agreed to take a train car to the end of the line in Perrysville and then walk north to Butler. But along the way, they got hungry. So they stopped for a bite to eat at the White House Hotel in what is now Ross Township. Then they got cold, so they broke into a schoolhouse and started a fire. Sitting around that fire, they agreed trudging through snow on foot was no way to travel, so they stole a horse and sleigh from a nearby barn. None of it went unnoticed. The jailbreak and that $1,000 reward were front page news, and citizens were quick to phone the police with tips. Detectives easily tracked the Biddles' journey, and when they received word that the trio had stopped at a home in Mount Chestnut, Butler County, they headed for Prospect. Prospect is located just 4 miles north of Mount Chestnut, and detectives figured if they traveled south and the fugitives continued their march north, they'd eventually run into each other. Shortly before 5, on the evening of Friday, January 31st, the Seekers and the Sot converged on the snow-covered Butler Newcastle Road in Franklin Township, Butler County. Not surprisingly, the Biddles were armed and unwilling to surrender. "I don't care if there's a whole regiment of officers around me," Ed told an Allegheny County jail chaplain shortly before his escape. "I will fight until I die." Detectives opened fire and immediately hit both brothers, who tumbled from their sleigh and landed in the snow below. Within moments, their blood stained that snow red. But remembering how Detective Fitzgerald had died, detectives continued to fire until they were certain the Biddles couldn't fire back. They cuffed the injured men and threw them into a police carriage. Meanwhile, Kate Soffel and the horse-drawn sleigh kept moving, cutting across a field until detectives on horseback managed to chase it down. They found Soffel alive, but with a gaping wound in her chest, believed to be self-inflicted. They rushed Soffel to the Butler Hospital, where doctors opened her up and found that the bullet had cut through her abdomen, following the path of a rib, and then lodged in her back. They removed it, but they worried she may not survive an infection. Meanwhile, authorities took Ed and Jack to the Butler County Jail, where they were placed on gurneys and wheeled into separate cells. A doctor arrived and predicted the pair wouldn't last long. So the warden allowed reporters in to interview the men and record their last words. They were an ugly sight, especially Jack, who had 18 bullet wounds, 16 inflicted by detectives. The other two occurred when he placed his own gun in his mouth and fired. The three of them, Jack, Ed, and Kate, had made a suicide pact, Jack explained to reporters, because they'd rather die than return to prison, or in Kate's case, go to prison. "She did all she could with us," Jack said of Kate, "betrayed her husband, deserted her family, all to help us out." Across the hall, Ed shared the same sentiment. "She gave up everything for us, and I was bound to stick to her." Eventually, Jack grew weak. The doctor pushed through the gaggle of reporters to check on him. "You only have moments to live," the doctor said. Jack nodded and then asked to see his brother. When guards wheeled Jack across the corridor, the reporters followed, and they watched as Ed reached for his brother's hand and held it. "Goodbye, Jack," he said. 3 hours later, Ed died too. Their bodies were dressed in black suits, placed in pine coffins, and situated side by side in the hallway of the jail. More than 5,000 people traveled through a snowstorm to see them or to visit the field where they'd been shot. The snow fell so fast and the drifts grew so large that many had to stay in Butler overnight. Finally, on February 3rd, deputies loaded the bodies onto a Pittsburgh and Western train that was headed south and running several minutes behind schedule. The delay allowed the word of the brothers to spread in Pittsburgh, and a crowd soon formed there as well. Ed and Jack's brother, Harry Biddle, came down from Knoxville to claim the bodies at the Allegheny County Morgue. He and his wife had to sell their restaurant and pawn many of their belongings just to pay for the funerals. Kate Soffel didn't get to say goodbye to Ed and Jack. She ended up with that infection that doctors had dreaded. When reporters told Soffel of their deaths, she lamented, "I'm a bad woman. I only love my children. You know, there are many domestic troubles that only a woman can understand. If I live, I know I will go to prison. I only feel for my children. I hope I shall die." She didn't explain the domestic troubles, and she didn't explain her relationship with Ed, leaving the city to speculate. And speculate they did. Some were sure she had fallen in love with Ed. Others thought she honestly believed in their innocence and was only trying to free them. One county official had another theory, which he announced at a meeting of the prison board. "I believe Edward Biddle is a hypnotist. He could scarcely have gained such complete control of a woman like Mrs. Soffel otherwise." Whatever the truth, Kate Soffel's life was upended. A judge sentenced her to 2 years in the Western Penitentiary for aiding and abetting the Biddle brothers. While she served her time, Peter Soffel filed for divorce, claiming that his wife had been intimate with at least 5 men during their marriage. Kate contested the claims and the divorce, but the case was all but decided when, at a hearing on October 21st, 1903, the jury read a note that Ed had written to Kate, calling her darling and declaring his undying love, and then offering her instructions on how to smuggle saws and guns into the jail. They deliberated for just 10 minutes before granting the divorce. Peter later remarried and raised the Soffel children with his new wife. After her release from the penitentiary, Kate had few friends and little money. She tried to lean into the crime, agreeing to star as herself in a stage play about her life, but it quickly got shut down. So she did a 180, working as a seamstress under an assumed name to hide her identity. By 1909, she was dead, downed by typhoid fever, and her story surfaced once again. This time, at least, she had a few defenders. One of Kate Soffel's clients wrote this letter to the Pittsburgh Press in the days after her death. "Just a word in defense of Catherine Dietrich Soffel. One of the papers stated that she had no particular ailment but died of a complication of diseases. I think it's safe to say that hard work killed her. I knew her in a business way only. She sewed for me. In fact, she did not know I knew she was Mrs. Soffel. The last time I visited her dressmaking establishment, about 6 weeks ago, happened to be a morning after she had worked all night on a gown for a prominent Allegheny woman. A more pitiable object than she, I never saw. She was on the verge of prostration then, but she never complained, never sought the sympathy of anyone. All she knew was work, work, work. If there was anything to be regretted in her life, she atoned for it, and died atoning. I saw her many times. Would that I possessed language strong enough to extol her virtues. They were many." Kate Soffel's story did not die with her. In 1984, Diane Keaton and Mel Gibson starred as Kate and Ed in a movie about the saga. I haven't seen it, but it gets a 36% on Rotten Tomatoes, so do with that what you will. Sappy movie renditions not your thing? You can still hear about Kate Soffel by going on a Pittsburgh ghost tour. One of the stops is an old house on Mount Washington, where Soffel's family once lived. According to the legend, Kate still roams the house at night, peering out the windows or standing before the dining room mirror in a white dress. That house is now occupied by the Shiloh Grill. If you go, get the frozen Cosmo. Thanks for listening to Nebby. This episode was researched, written, and produced by me, April Johnston. If you'd like more information on that research or on the music used in this episode, check out the show notes or head to nebbypittsburgh.com. Since it's summer, I thought we'd have a little bit of fun in the next episode. So join me in a few weeks for the story of one of Pittsburgh's favorite warm weather destinations. Thank you. While you're waiting for that, please take a minute to rate and review Nebby on Apple Podcasts. It seems simple, but it really does help others find the show. That's it. See you soon with more stories of Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes.